Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
All right, Murph, we're off and running here, man. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, Don?
Good. For those that don't know, you're down in Georgia, right?
I am. I'm in Statesboro, Georgia, which is right outside of Savannah. So in the southeast part of the state of Georgia, which is a big old state. If you ever drive it from Savannah all the way up to Dalton, it'll take you probably 7 hours, if not a little bit more. So it's a big state. A lot of diversity of lifestyle, academia. They have a great state academic system, the USG system, which consists of Georgia Tech and UGA and schools like Georgia Southern. And the weather's great. I'll take a Statesboro summer over a Boston winter any day. So life is
good. You've been all over the country, man. For those, I suppose maybe some of our audience doesn't know you, but for the old timers like me, who've been through the coaching system, you know, I went through it in the 90s, in the 2000s. But the name John Murphy popped up quite often because you've been all around and you've coached at, I guess, virtually every level in the country, from some of the biggest schools and biggest names like, you know, Brown and Boston College and Clemson, for Pete's sake. As big as you get on the college side to the MLS. You've had a varied career, man.
Yeah. Besides being accused of being an old timer, everything was pretty accurate there, Don. So. Yeah, it's you don't think about those things when you're doing them, and you look back and you're like, holy cow, that's a lot of work. And even, you know, working in youth soccer, you know, took a couple teams to the national Final Fours and lost in a NPL national championship 1 year, and, you know, had a lot of kids on state teams that ended up going on and having great student athlete careers in college. You hope you impact a lot of people. I've had some special people impact me. When you say Clemson and Boston College and Brown, I think of Mike Noonan and Ed Kelly. You know, I think of the people that I work with. When you talk about MLS, I think about Stevie Nichol and Greg Andrulis and Fernando Clavijo and the people that I work with at that level. So at the end of the day, as you know, whatever level we're talking about people. And the thing that I found the most interesting when we're talking about asset-based approaches, when we're talking about treating players as people first, that got reinforced every level I went up more and more. You would think that the pros don't care about that. The pros care quite a bit. They care quite a bit about how you engage with them and how you interact with them. And I would like to think that was part of any success that I had at that level, working in the pros for 10 years, is I care about people. I try and connect with them. I try and figure out how I can help them. And when you're an assistant coach, you can be a little bit more individualistic. And when you're a head coach, you got to look at the big picture. But at the end of the day, it's about people and motivating them and bringing them together. And that's nothing new. That's coaching. And it's always been that way. So the fact that it's becoming more and more of a topic, player-centered approaches, it's almost like tactics. We're talking about tactics, Don, today that you well know 30 years ago we were implementing, and 30 years before us they were implementing in the
I know, the 50s, John. It cracks
the
50s up.
And the 60s. And so, you know, it tends to go in cycles, I guess.
I love it. And it's exciting because you see young coaches now have social media and they can post things, but they don't know they're not reinventing the wheel. I mean, we can go all the way back to, you know, to the Puskas eras and the WM formation.
Exactly.
We can go through the history of zonal man marking, and then how you know, the Italians went into the first zonal, successfully winning World Cups through zonal defending, and we can talk about all of that. Now people want to talk man marking again, and you're right. It just cycles and circles around because honestly, there's only so many ways to play this game. It's
That's right.
22 men or players on the field, and there's one ball and there's two goals. You're trying to conquer one and defend the other. And
Yeah.
it's the same concepts. And I was, you know, you we can go all the way back to Sun Tzu and the Art of War, and you
That's
can
it.
read all about soccer tactics in the Art of War. This
Yeah.
is thousands and thousands of years old. And all created to simulate war, how
Yeah.
to attack and how
Yeah.
to defend. And
Yeah.
there's nothing new under the sun, the Bible says. And
Yeah.
there's it's
I
so
think it's
it's
your
so true.
I think it's your delivery, it's your personality, it's your humanness. I think that we've had multiple iterations of coaches in various sports in this country. Let's just focus on the 20th century going forward. But we tend to focus on the General Patton, General Eisenhower mentality, whether it be Bobby Knight or Newt Rockne or Bear Bryant. We like that idea of the coach as the authoritarian, the command style. And as you well know, and because it's such an eclectic game, such an international game, there's different ways of looking at it, and different cultures will look at how coaches can engage with players. And I think as Americans, we're getting better and better at finding new ways to connect with people rather than the old way of do it because I told you to. Those days are over. We have to find new ways to connect with people. The trust really needs to be established, and that takes time. And then once trust is established at any level of play, then you have to decide, all right, who's in front of me? Who am I talking to? What am I actually trying to get out of this individual or this team? So you can't coach a U10 team like a professional team. It's ridiculous. It's
Right,
or a high school team like a professional team. And this is where we do have issues where, you could, in theory, do a coaching course, you could do a B license, and you have a USL assistant coach who's taking the course with a Division One head women's coach and a high school coach. You have three different levels, three different coaches, and of course, you're always going to try and gravitate towards the high level. The high school coach could actually come away from that course, trying to integrate and implement either college or professional standards into their work. And that's where I think we have to be careful. We certainly don't have to dummy down our efforts, but we do need to be aware of various standards, physically, mentally, what individuals can take in and what they can actually do in their athletic output. So that is all part of coach education and just having that intelligence of context and awareness that people come from different places and have different motivations for participation as well. So I think all these things are important, regardless of what level you're talking about. Even if you start getting up into the college, there's some kids that are on scholarship, there's some kids that are on some name, image, and likeness money, and there's kids that are walk-ons. There's varying levels of motivation there. And until you get to a professional level where they are actually signing a contract for performance, anything below that is going to be varying levels of motivation.
I like that. And you know what? I also like the fact that you keep talking about the humanity and how we're dealing with people. There is this, it's growing. It's very concerning to me and disconcerting. It bothers me that there's this growing trend with younger coaches to say it's just business. We're just dealing with business, especially with college soccer. So, yeah, don't take it personally when if coaches recruit you and then cut you 6 months later, and players saying, yeah, don't take it personally if I commit to you and then decommit and then recommit to somebody else and then decommit, and hey, everybody's just out for themselves, it's just business. And it bothers me. I look at this from the coach's perspective, but I can also see the player's perspective. But from the coach's perspective, I always looked at it as, hey, I recruited you. I own you for 4 years. If I made a mistake recruiting you because you're not the right player for my team, that's my fault. How is that your fault? I'm not going to uproot you and uproot your, and disrupt your family because I made a mistake. I'm going to figure out how to get the best out of you as a player and to help you grow up. I always said college is, it's the last bastion of youth going into adulthood. And I always saw myself as a college coach having to help usher that player into adulthood when their parents weren't going to be around them on a daily basis anymore. And that was my responsibility. And I think a lot of my friends that started coaching with me around the same time in the 90s and felt the same way. And it bothers me to no end, John, that some of these younger coaches, not all of them, I interview and I talk to a lot of great young college coaches who really love these kids and don't cut players just because, they weren't the best 15 on the squad. But there is this growing trend, and it's carrying through over from the players that, hey, if the coaches treat it like it's just business, then I'll treat it just like it's just business. And we're in the people business. We're dealing with people that have to perform just like you would in any business. I don't know. Are you noticing this at all, or are you
I think that you and I saw it the same, and perhaps I got out just in time because I was the same way. I've had kids over the years that if we've gotten the assessment wrong, then I try and find a way to make it work. Give them the reality of what it was going to be, and if they didn't want to be around, then I could help them transfer. And actually spent quite a bit of time helping kids transfer and find other places where I know a lot of coaches wouldn't have done that. So I can only speak for myself. You and I sound like kindred spirits, but we're dinosaurs. That time is over, and we've been dancing and playing that game for a long time, and we all have to be honest. It's the same thing with the overall the pay-to-play concept, which people are very critical of. But most of us participate in it, so it's kind of hypocritical to criticize the system that we are participating in. So, for example, we recruit kids, and we would tell them, to come to our camp, so we can evaluate you, which was a legitimate way of evaluating people, but it's also feeding into your camp business, and you're trying to bring people in and get them on campus. And there's a lot of different things that can accomplish a lot of positive things that can come from that type of thing. But the reality of it is, if you're getting one or two kids from 150 kids that attend your camp, you're doing pretty well. On the other hand, the kids and the parents would do the same thing. They tell you that they're interested in your school, and they're shopping when they get your scholarship offer, they're shopping at the five or six other people or other institutions. So that had been going on for a while. Now it's with name, image, and likeness, it has really flowed into a different world now where the verbal commitment doesn't really mean anything on either side. The young person can come in, have a good season, and immediately leave and move to greener pastures. And people say it's more professional, but it's not. In the pros, you again, I alluded to earlier, a contract keeps a player at least on side for the length of the contract. The young kids now, they don't have anything holding them back, and in theory, they can move from school to school and pick up name, image, and likeness money. And the conclusion I've come to, if the kids feel like you owe them everything and they owe you nothing, you have a big problem. And I think that's a problem right now for college sports. And I'm only going to focus on how it impacts the sport of soccer. There's a real trickle-down effect, unfortunately, where most of the money is going to be up in football and the basketballs and sports like that. And soccer, they're feeding on the scraps. And there's some money being chucked around. And my connections aren't as great on the women's side, but on the men's side, there is definitely some money being chucked around. So it's unsustainable for me. As a concept, hopefully the NCAA gets a hold of it and gets it under control. But getting back to what we were talking about relationships and connecting and developing, it really contradicts those concepts, because you're really not getting time to develop trust. You're not getting time to get to know the person better. I agree with you. The adult in the situation is the one that has to fall on his or her sword and sacrifice a little bit more. But now that this door is open with kids going in and out to different schools, now the coaches are just dropping kids, and it really is. It's not conducive to an academic setting where, as you said, this is really the last opportunity for these people to be young people, learn to make some mistakes, some life mistakes, hopefully not, the serious ones, but mistakes that they can learn from. Certainly being on a sports team, picking up concepts of social inclusion, conflict resolution, working with people, having conversations with people that may not see the world the same way as you. I mean, college sports still has a huge value. But I think we're hurting it. We're limiting its effectiveness by the way it's being interpreted, particularly in the past 5 years.
Yeah, and it's such a bummer that the non-revenue generating Olympic sports, my analogy is, I picture somebody water skiing and they fall down, get tangled up in the rope, but that boat just keeps driving, man. And the boat is being driven by American football and men's basketball, and they do not care who gets drugged behind that boat and what damage is being done. But because it truly is apples and oranges, man. What is going on? The amount of money that the NCAA generates in out of American football and March Madness is number one, but American football money is number two. And those are what is driving all the other sports, from soccer to lacrosse to bowling. Why would you have non-revenues? It's insane that to me that University of Washington is in the ACC. What are we doing? What are we doing here? And it has to do with football and basketball.
It's tough, and my concern is with women's soccer, they're always going to have that protection of Title IX. So I don't see the same thing happening that I'm worried about happening on the men's side for men's Division One. I'm worried that it's going to end up being like Division One ice hockey, where you're going to have 40 to 60 programs, and universities are just going to step away from men's soccer. Top American players tend to be going straight into the pro system, or a year in college straight into the pros. And they're misinterpreting the trend. I think there's a huge value for Division One men's soccer. It needs to continue. My concern is if it goes to the 2 semester model, there's going to be universities that will step away from men's soccer because they don't have the facilities or the resources to be able to keep up, and it's a concern. So you're talking about how we've gone from regional leagues now to programs crisscrossing the country. Without a doubt, you're absolutely correct. That's a huge concern. Mine goes far deeper than that. My concern is your analogy of the water skier dangling off the edge, hanging on for dear life. I think if they don't get around it and come up with some kind of a system that's financially viable in the long run, I'm concerned about men's soccer programs being dropped. I really am.
Yeah, we're starting to see it in other sports. If people don't believe it's happening, we're seeing, men's tennis being dropped at schools and track and field and lacrosse, and we're seeing men's sports being dropped. It's starting to happen, starting to actually happen. And we've seen men's soccer programs struggling, and then you add into that the numbers that we are starting to see. And people that you've been around in education long enough, and so have I, to know that the financial numbers at institutions tends to be 3 to 5 years behind what the general economy does because of the way that budgets are set. And we're starting now in 2026 to see the effects of COVID in 20 and 21 and even into 2022 trickle through the system. And then you add to that AI, and the concerns that parents and and students, young students have about, are we going to have young lawyers? We don't need young lawyers to do what young lawyers used to do, which is sit in the law library and research anymore. AI can do that far, far more efficiently and better. Are we going to have jobs coming out, research jobs coming out with AI? And so what does that mean for the enrollment cliff, right? That we've been seeing start to happen throughout the country, and rising cost of tuition that, we've now got schools that have topped six figures in per year. I mean, who's got $400,000 sitting around for an education? How many years is it going to take to recoup that? And parents and players, students are realizing that, we may have a problem. So you combine all of that, the budget shortfalls that universities are having, and some of the biggest schools in the country are having some budget shortfalls going into the millions, high millions, hundreds of millions budget shortfalls, and with no real plan that I've heard to rectify it, except raise tuition rates again.
Yeah, I mean and all those things are true, and they're saying now that the next generations is going to be less and less kids, and there's going to be less and less kids that don't want to go to college. But getting back to what we're talking about here with these programs, I think the stigma of getting rid of programs is a lot less than it used to be. And you used to hear the general public, kick and scream. And when New Mexico men's soccer, went out, probably 10 years ago, I mean, it was absolute mind blower. I mean, that's a tough program and really,
Yeah,
really
Fishbein had that thing
disappointing.
running, yeah.
Really disappointing. But we avoided that a couple of years ago with Furman. I mean, I don't think people understand how close Furman was getting rid of men's soccer. They ended up getting rid of men's baseball, which in the South is incredible. And that just tells you how great of a job Doug Allison did at Furman for him to be able to protect that program through a time where their athletic department had to make some tough decisions, and they dropped men's baseball instead of men's soccer, which I think is incredible. And then obviously, Doug's gone on and just ended his career fantastically last year. And obviously that's a very strong program, but that's a program that was on the cusp of being dropped. So
Yeah.
this concerns with all of that. It feeds into, some of my concepts about my dissertation, which is, if less than 5% of high school kids end up going on and playing college soccer, I think on the girls' side it's 4.5, and I think on the boys' side it's like 3.5. Then what should the learning outcomes, what should the strategies be for high school coaches? What should they be focusing on? I'm not saying that you take away the competitiveness from it. There's a transactional aspect to sports. You're going to lose games, you're going
Yeah.
to get suspended, you're going to get red carded, you're going to get you're going to have to do some fitness punishments. I mean, like, those things are going to be in place. But I guess what I'm saying generally, what should be the expectation of a high school soccer coach from the athletic director, from that school department? Are they to focus on to helping them develop some life skills, some leadership skills, conflict resolution, concepts of social inclusion, getting together and talking to somebody, from a different background of yours? I think that's really where sports are so important, and high school sports are so important, because a lot of these young people are going to graduate from the high school and they're going to end up living in that community, and those are the new future leaders of that particular community. So what the coaches do, regardless of the sport, obviously my focus is going to be on soccer, but regardless of the sport, it's so important to be able to, lead these young people and give them some life experiences that they can take on, as well as their classroom and extracurricular activities that they participated in within the high school. Post-graduation, what do they do after that? Do they go to college? Do they go to a tech school? Do they enter the workforce? But we can't underestimate how important the high school coach is. So if that's the case, then how are we training our coaches? What is coach education focusing on? Are we really focusing strictly on tactics and techniques and sports psych, which of course should be at the heart of any certification program. But are we talking at all about how to deal with ever increasing eclectic student bodies? Our student population is changing. It's becoming more diverse. It's becoming more volatile. I think the kids are emotionally more intelligent than when you and I went to school. So, I think back when we went to school, an adult told us to do something, we just did it. The
Right.
kids, for better or worse, will not do that now. So you must find different ways to be able to connect with people. Again, build that trust, build that human connection, for strictly performance. Forget about if you really want to make an impact on this kid's life. So, my work isn't some pie in the sky. Let's remove competitiveness. Let's just make everything nicey nice. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is, if you are a competitive co high school coach, if you're a coach that really does want to get the best out of their group, I think concepts of social inclusion and development of life skills and development of leadership skills, along with discipline and all the things that we focused on over the years, they need to be integrated into a little bit more of a complex and nuanced approach as a coach. Therefore, there should be some representation of that in our coach education programs.
What are your thoughts on I know it's been a little while since you've been in the MLS, and things have changed quite a bit as far as youth soccer and youth academies. Of course, we have MLS Next, where I think all for but one club, maybe DC United, but everybody else, they pay for these kids. They take them in. If they need housing, they arrange housing. They'll bring in kids from all over the country. It's not pay to play. The club's footing the bill, with the MLS clubs at least. And have you started to notice a payoff to that system yet? And what do you think
Yeah,
about it? If these kids aren't playing high school now in that system. If they're homegrown, they're not playing high school.
and you alluded to it slightly. I think I'm a little outside of that right now. Really, MLS Next has really developed over the past, 2, 3 years, right when I was transitioning out of full-time coaching. But I think the concept I'm well aware of, and I think this is it's the old concept of making sausage. No one really wants to know how it's made. They're interested in eating the sausage. If you really want to develop talent, and you look at Brazil, Japan, any of these top countries, it's not a nice business. So it's not a nice business. You are literally taking hundreds of individuals to try and get 5% of that group to make your youth teams, and then eventually out of that group, maybe 3% of them end up having some kind of a professional career. So it is not a nice business. It's a numbers business, and it's trying to be addressed here with MLS Next. It's trying to be addressed by separating from the pay-to-play model. But in my experience, the real issue is the laws that we have for young people working, and I think that's really the difference, where a young German player is in a third division team, gets sold to a Bundesliga team. That club gets the money for that transfer. And the club will continue to get money for that transfer as that young person moves up in their career and they play a certain amount of first team games and then they end up playing for the German national team. Like, that club will continue to get money coming in for all the work that they put in to help develop that kid. That system is not in place, and I think there's federal laws that prohibit that type of thing. That may change with name, image, and likeness. I can't say I'm aware of it. I'm not paying that much attention to it, but I would think that that's eventually going to open up if you're seeing name, image, and likeness type money go trickling down into high schools, eventually you're gonna see maybe a perhaps a loosening up of how young players how their status can be interpreted within a business sense. And the transfer is really what clubs around the world invest in these young players, not only if they can
Right.
get on the field for them, but eventually transfer them on. So all the money that's being put into MLS Next, which is fantastic, and I think the clubs are doing the right thing in the short run, but in the long run, I don't know what the payoff's going to be because you really do not get the financial payoff. You do not get the
Right.
exchange of money, which really works within a club system. We have a franchise system. That's why it's slightly different. People clamoring for promotion relegation, which all soccer romantics love the idea of, but the reality of it is, from a business standpoint, it's probably not going to work in this country because people that put their money up do not want to see their money utilized that way. And
Right.
maybe that will change in time. I don't think it will. So to
I
get to your
don't think
point
so
about
either.
MLS Next, I mean, I think it's fantastic. We need to get a more clear, two paths need to be clarified. Soccer for social inclusion, soccer for recreation, soccer for participation, and then elite pathways to sport. And I think you see that in a lot of other countries much more clear. I think it's much more blurred in this country due to the pay-to-play system, where people are not going to pay that kind of money if they feel like their kid's in a recreation system. They want to think that their kid's in an elite system, but the reality, it's contradictory. I mean, you can't have that many clubs involved in a quote unquote elite system. It really is, it's window dressing. So MLS Next is taking us in a direction towards a little bit more of a professional setting, but in the short run, it's a good adjustment and development. In the long run, I don't see it working unless somehow you can start to transfer talent from club to club and there's money being exchanged, because that's the system you have worldwide.
The irony is that years ago, 25 years ago, we actually had a system that promoted the best players and the best teams up through into the national level, and that pro coaches and college coaches could go see the best players in the country competing for the Maguire Cup, and we had an ODP system where, the you went to the California state ODP play days, and you saw, some of literally some of the best players in the country in one place. And if you went to regionals, you absolutely saw ballers, pure ballers. And when you went to nationals in the ODP system, it was the best of the best. It was a very simple system, and it's just so wild how, I mean, it tried to get perverted with the Super Y League. They tried, and it didn't make it. And then ECNL took off, and when the men's side saw what was going on the women's side, it took off, and now we've got what we've got, and it's made talent. I really don't envy college coaches right now, or national team scouts, because where do you go, and how much money does it cost now to be able to scout, the National League and USYS and US Soccer now, which is combining. And then, on the girls' side, you've got the Girls Academy, and you've got ECNL, and you've got ECRL, and you've got MLS2, and it's so spread out, and we know that we are missing players, and we know we are missing, really, really good players that are playing in local Latin leagues, for example. I've come across kids that turned out to be college stars and ended up playing Division One that nobody knew about, because I went to a Latin league game in Las Vegas that I heard about a kid. And I went and watched him play against other adults, and I said, "Holy crud, this kid is really good." And it's made more, it's been, we've made it more complicated, I think.
Yeah, I you're definitely on something. I've been banging on the drum about ODP. I mean, we have unique issues in this country, and one of them is the pure mass, the pure size of the country is really overwhelming. And this is what I try to explain to people, when I was coaching in MLS, and trying to explain to my friends overseas. I mean, it has to be one of the most, and it still is one of the most difficult leagues in the world to play in, just for the pure travel. So if you're playing for the New England Revolution, you're flying to play LA Galaxy. I mean, that is a really tough trip. And I don't care if they've gotten to the point where they have charters now, but back when we were doing it, we were flying economy, and it was not nice, and it really takes a lot out of you. But that's why I thought the ODP system made a lot of sense. And I think, like everything, we're trying to improve things, and then we just throw things away and start over. I think if we could have built on the concept of splitting the country into four main regions, which we did, and then within those regions, create subdivisions where there's subdivisions within the regions, and then it cuts
Right.
down on travel expenses. You can share resources. So instead of, teams from Florida flying up to Atlanta, why can't the Atlanta teams, drive down to Savannah and meet the Florida teams in Savannah? It cuts down on a little bit of
Right.
travel, and they can play there. Like, we just need to do a better job. I think we can do it. We have the spaces and the resources, but as you alluded to, we have all these varying iterations of governing bodies, and I think that's what makes it difficult to be able to get everybody on the same page. But ultimately, if you ask people, what is the bottom line? What are we looking to do? You alluded a little bit to college coaches. I know plenty of people that don't care about the college coaches. They don't care. They want us to identify the best players for the pro league, or they want us to identify the best
Right.
players
Well, you can see
for.
that when you go to MLS Next Events. It's very
Yeah.
clear that they do not care
So.
if the college coaches show up or not. They don't
Yeah,
care.
and but there's a difference. I don't expect MLS Next people to be falling all over themselves for college coaches, but at the same time, I go to see a youth Bundesliga game in Germany, and I get a form at the beginning of the game. It has both lineups. It has the subs. I mean, they didn't make that for me as a college coach. They made that for the people in the stands, the fans, just like a little program.
Right.
So you can still have that mindset of, we're not really setting this up for anybody. We're setting it up to try to identify the best players. But there's a way that you can be professional about it as well. I think sometimes we take it a little too far. And whether college coaches should be a priority at these MLS Next events or not is not the point. The point is that the college sports is still quite viable and important in this country, and there needs to be some kind of a compromise made where it's a little bit more, instead of us trying to copy other countries exclusively, just put an American twist onto the things that we're doing. And I want MLS Next to grow and develop, and I want our top players to push on, but we also can't totally discount the college game, which is ridiculous. The college game is help soccer tick over in this country at times where we had nothing else. We didn't have anything. We
Yeah,
didn't have a
very
pro
true.
league. We didn't, anybody who thinks less of these college coaches, they don't know anything. Some of these college coaches are the best of the best. Mike Noonan is as good as anybody in this
Agreed.
country and outside this country. Sasha Sarofsky, as good as anybody.
Yeah,
I could rattle
right.
off 15 names. Todd Yeager, all of these guys, more than capable. Jamie Clark, more than capable of stepping into any professional situation and to be able to excel, just like Bruce Arena did, just like Dave Sarachan
Right.
did, just like Bob Bradley did. So, this ridiculous notion that the college game is poor, inferior, is wrong. And I'll take it one further. I think a lot of these countries, they would kill for the college system that we have. They would love to have a college system like that in Germany, where young people can go and get a degree and play some kind of a level of sport. They have to make a decision. They have to do one or the other. And they would love to have something similar to us. So I think in our quest to try to improve things, which we always should, and we should always be striving to improve, we also should be trying to stay, understanding of the different challenges that we have in this country. One is we have a huge geographic problem, and I think we need to regionalize all of our efforts within the region. So I like the idea of four regions, and then within those regions, you have subdivisions, whatever you want to call them. And I'm talking about at every level of game, including college, where you're cutting down on all this cross-country travel, which is $25,000 bucks a trip every time, at least, if not more. And it puts a lot of pressure on budgets and things like that. So you're going to have programs like University in Denver. They're geographically isolated. Out in the West is a little bit different. But I mean, the Midwest, the Northeast, the Southeast, you can regionalize all of that, have some fantastic competition, get, more rest in, more quality games, better student athlete experience. So this is just college, of course. And then going down to the youth levels, I think it's ridiculous for these teams to be traveling any more than a couple hours to a game. I mean, they should try and keep it as close as possible and try to uniform it somehow. You don't want to water you don't want to water down the level, but at the same time too, we also can't be feeding into this system where it takes a lot of money for families to be able to participate. It makes it very difficult. And like you said, I think perhaps we're missing out on talent because people cannot participate in that system.
Yeah, it's tough. You talked we talked a little bit about the two semester model, and I kind of get where you're coming from. And I frankly, I at the end of the day, I don't think it's going to pass just because of the number of mid-majors out there that do not have the budgets to support it. I think you're only talking about the top schools with loads of money that are going to be able to afford it. So we'll see what happens. But the other hot topic that's been talked about is the 5 and 5. So, kids' clocks will truly start when they graduate high school or 19 years old, whichever comes first, and then they'll get 5 years with no waivers of anything, with the exceptions of military service, or if they're out on a mission, like I think at the Mormon Church we think about most frequently, where they take a year or two off for a religious mission. And but other than that, there's not going to be any exceptions, because one of the most common complaints that we get, it's from the guy's side, it's not coming from the girl's side. We don't have this issue with the women's game, but with the men's game, we have a 23-year-old kid who's been kicking around in the Oberliga, not really getting paid, but decides, I'm at the end of it. I'm not going to make it. Let me go over and I'll just be in America for 2 years. Maybe I'll get picked up in the USL. And then they come in for their 2 years of eligibility. They're 23-year-old freshmen. I've heard stories of older ones, and I still can't work out the math, Murph, how this happens. But still, these kids come in with a year or two eligibility. And it shuts out the number of spots available for the true 18-year-old. And of course, American parents complain that, why are we bringing any foreign players in? Period. We should have zero foreign players. When you see what it's done to, soccer, forget about it. Look what it's done to tennis and hockey, and you'll see it's way bigger numbers. But 5 for 5 addresses part of it. What do you think of that change idea? Because that one I think is going to pass. I think 5 and 5 is going to pass.
And just briefly on the two semester model, and this is what I try to explain to my friends. If it's all soccer people sitting around and talking, the two semester model makes perfect sense.
Oh yeah,
All of
from a
us want
soccer
the two
developmental
semester.
standpoint, 100%.
But we're not talking to soccer people.
Yeah.
We're talking about, people who are administrators and,
Right.
that are either indifferent or do not like soccer. So we got to be clear here that you have to account for there are people out there that, at the very least are indifferent to soccer. And there's a handful of athletic directors out there There's some really great ones. Chris Davis of Georgia Southern's fantastic athletic director that loves soccer. So I know we have advocates out there. You can't tell me it's anything more than a third of the athletic directors in the country that are advocates for soccer and care about soccer. So that's the problem with the two semester model, and all the things that you're alluding to, the Midwest, the Northeast, is they do not have the facilities, the space, or the resources to be able to participate, unfortunately. Yeah, the 5 for 5, you're going to have to make some kind of a limitation, either with the window of time when the clock starts, or how many transfers a person is allowed. There has to be some kind of structure. I don't think we have to go completely xenophobic and say that we shouldn't have international students over here or international student athletes over here. I disagree with that. If we're talking about what's great about Clemson, what's great about St. Louis, what's great about UCLA is, that soccer being played at the very highest level. And Indiana traditionally has gone American, UCLA has traditionally gone American, and Clemson has traditionally gone international. And that's back from the 70s, when they were bringing in Nigerian national team members, and it was supposed to be absolute lights out. So if we're trying to have the highest level of college soccer, you can't inhibit it for people outside the United States. And this is what I would say to, the parents and the kids, the Americans. If you want to compete at that level, then everyone needs to step up a little bit. And I'm not talking about stepping up, spending more money and going to camp. I'm not talking about stepping up and going to a better club. But how many of these kids are training on their own? How many of these kids are going out and working out? How many of these kids are going out and calling up their buddies? Let's do a pickup game like we used to do in the old days, Don, because it was the Stone Age and we didn't have anything, like I was a basketball player, played pickup basketball 3, 4, 5 hours a day, like every day. You're going to get better, and that's where I'll critique American players. They tend to sit back, and because they train 3 times a week with their club and they play a high level, then they shut it down the other couple days a week. And if you want to be at the best, these kids from Germany, these kids from Sweden, these kids from Brazil, they're in pro clubs and these kids are training every day and they know what it takes to be the best. Those are the kids that you have to compete against. So that's where I'm a little critical of the American player. I don't know if we're there yet. I don't know if we put the time and the energy into developing ourselves that perhaps some of these kids do from other cultures and other countries. So that's I'm sympathetic to the American student athlete. I'm sympathetic for them getting opportunities to play, and it doesn't have to be Division One. There's great Division Twos, Division Threes, junior college. I played junior college. It was a phenomenal experience for me. There's different levels of the game that you can participate in, but if you want to play in college, you're gonna need to take that next step. I don't mean to generalize, but it seems like to me the American the average American player does not put the time in that would put them in a good situation to be able to compete against these kids from other countries. So we can talk about two semester model. We can talk about the amount of time that's being allowed. If you can't even get anywhere near it because you're not up to the standard, then it feeds back to what I'm talking about with my dissertation. What are we talking about here? What is high school sports for? What are we trying to accomplish? MLS Next is trying to separate the high school experience, from their participants, which is another argument perhaps for another day. But if you're going to participate in high school sports, really, what should be the focus and the goals, besides trying to compete and win and try and help your team win a championship? There has to be more to it than just that.
Yeah, it's yeah, so it's so funny because I've seen it firsthand. I took over a college team back in 2010 that was all Americans, 100% Americans. And the first and second year mostly Americans. And when the Champions League came on, nobody was asking to watch the Champions League. This is a college team. These kids didn't even know what was going on. When I started recruiting internationals, they would start saying, once I got over 50, 60% internationals on my team, Coach, can we train at 5 o'clock so that we can watch a Champions League in the afternoon? And then can you put it on the big screen in this room so we can all watch it together? So it's not just the Americans training on their own. It's the passion for the game that is still cultural. Look, it's so much better, John. You and I have
Oh,
been
sure.
around soccer through the 60s and the 70s and the 80s when you couldn't find it on television. And I remember even when I was married in the 80s with my wife saying, I wonder if there'll ever be a commercial on television showing a soccer ball instead of baseball, instead of basketball. And now we have it's better culturally, but we're still so far away from other countries culturally and how they feel about the game, and we have a separation of cultures here in the United States where this pocket is passionate, but this pocket doesn't even still really know that it exists on the world stage,
Yeah.
and pockets that are a little bit different because we're clearly the most culturally diverse nation, I think, on planet Earth. I don't think there's another nation that even comes close to our cultural diversity.
Yeah,
And it affects
no.
soccer.
Yeah, but for me it's more of a superficial, it's a superficial improvement of passion for the game. I remember watching the 1986 World Cup final in my buddy's basement, ABC Sports, Wild World of Sports, and nobody would watch it with me. I was in the basement watching it by myself, and everybody was
Right.
outside in the pool, and now you get all the games on, but until we get to a point, and hopefully we're just going through a trend, but any of the kids that watch our U.S. national team play and on June 12th, I think, when then we play their opening game, how many of these kids are going to go then run outside after the game and play soccer? Are going to, at halftime go out and, try and do a bicycle kick? I hate to say it. I think a lot of them are just going to go to their phones. They're going to go play video games. And this is part of a greater issue within, Western society. And it's happening in a lot of other countries as well. I have friends in Germany that are telling me the same thing's going on. So,
In Holland, yeah, they, yeah.
So I mean, it's just more of a, we don't have a culture where it's ingrained into every aspect of our lives. So our kids will watch the games. The TV ratings will be fantastic. Our watch parties will be great. There'll be a lot of energy in and around it. And hopefully, it inspires young people. Hopefully, this World Cup is another, platform for us to take the game another step forward at every level. We have the Women's World Cup coming here in 2032. So we have these 5 years. Can we focus on really developing the game as coach educators, as administrators, as coaches, and try and make it, as good as we can for these young people? But the kids have to have the passion and the energy inside them. It can't be driven by the parents. And I do think that's an issue we have in this country. It's a little bit more of a superficial interest in the game rather than something that's really passionate and something that's really important. And I hope I'm wrong. I hope it's more of a trend that I'm noticing in the things, as our country becomes more diverse and these different cultures are now, hopefully assimilating and integrating into our country, that we bring in a little bit more of that passion to the game. My mother was from Scotland, and that's how I got my introduction to the game, and really my love for the game and passion, comes from a Scottish heart. And then all the guys I played in college with were all Portuguese and Cape Verdes and fantastic guys, and learned a lot from them as well. So, again, that social inclusion piece to soccer is so important. And as you said, your American players learning from some of your foreign players about the importance of the game, the beauty of the game, whatever. Hopefully that continues to grow, but sometimes I think it's just a little superficial in this country, and it just reflects some greater issues we have with, I guess, popular culture.
Yeah, and look, we also live in a society where everybody wants everything right now. And this is one of those things that's going to take a little bit of time. I was a first generation soccer player, started in 1973, I guess. And it we in the San Francisco East Bay area, which for anybody who knows, Oakland, California, on through to Fremont, California, as it's millions and millions of people, we couldn't fill up a football field with the league that we had, an American football field on opening day. All the teams lined up, and there wasn't enough to fill it. And now, my son has played, and now my grandson is playing. And so it becomes over time, generational. Over time, it just takes time to build into the culture.
And that's in California, which, for me, California from the outside looking in has always seemed like everyone talks about, St. Louis, and rightly so, but really, California for me, you look at it where, they've had, youth soccer going there since the mid 60s, and I mean the game has just grown so much. And plenty states are way behind California, so we still have a ways to go. But yeah, I again, we have to take a look at, what are we trying to do? So what's important about youth soccer in, Fremont, California? Is it important because we're trying to develop the next Landon Donovan, or is it important because it creates opportunities for all of us to come together? It gives young people chances to come together, parents and friends to be able to come together, to be able to compete. There's nothing wrong with competing. I think berating a young referee is a big warning flag for me in this country. We have to be very, very careful where we're taking that. Are we trying to get these kids from Fremont, California, to eventually play for the high school team? And if so, why? Is it to help them propel to a soccer scholarship, or is it to enrich their student athlete experience at that particular high school, so when they graduate, they're better prepared to be able to negotiate the next step of their life, enter the workforce, tech school, university, community college, whatever they decide to do. So sports can be used as a great tool, as you well know, Don, and I know a lot of the people listening understand that. So I don't think my dissertation is going to be covering anything that's going to be blow anybody's mind. But ultimately, we must prepare as coaches for an ever increasing eclectic population, and therefore, how do we address people from different value systems, different backgrounds? Forget about a kid moving from Nebraska to Fremont, but a kid moving from South Korea to Fremont. How does that co coach deal with a kid whose English isn't as strong? Parents don't speak English. They just came here, that type of thing. And these are challenges that coaches have been negotiating for decades. But the focus of this dissertation is perhaps we need to start addressing it in our coach education. And again, do you do it in a way where you're just ticking a box and it's a module, and that way it's disingenuous and there's real no value to it? I'm also not espousing ripping up a coach education and changing it completely. The point is, can we find some balance? And I'll have some recommendations at the end of the study, perhaps how we can, better prepare high school coaches to be able to deal with these challenges within the coach education system.
I know you said you were about half, we talked off the air before, you're about halfway through your dissertation. And what, so start at the beginning real quick, just to, what was the impetus? What made you said this is where I want to start it, and what are you hoping to get out of your study?
It's like there's a concept called a causal chain. So what is it connected to? So my doctoral studies is in curriculum studies, which is an educational tract. It's basically space and place, concepts of intersectionality. Very, very interesting. So when I had to come up with a dissertation topic, I had to tie it into that. I had to tie it into, educational concepts, theoretical frameworks, regardless of what I decided to do. Because of my background in the game, coach education always interested me. So I wanted to try and tie something in with coach education. Now, if I wanted to base it on my background, I could have done coach educations in the pros. I could have done coach education in college. But for me, high school made the most sense because it ties back into curriculum studies, which is an educational framework. We're trying to work with kids. There's no use of me doing it in elementary school because now you're really talking about a much lower level and levels that I've really not delved into too much. I have pretty strong concepts of high school soccer because I was a college coach for years and years, but I've never coached high school soccer. So, we all have our gaps. So eventually I came to the conclusion that I was going to focus on coach education and how it impacted high school sports. So obviously you're talking about the coach. All of us, the only reason why we coach is to help the players underneath us. So ultimately, the causal chain is how are high school student athletes being impacted by their experiences playing soccer? And then how can we, whatever gaps can be found there, how can those be addressed by coach education? Coach education, in turn, where in the curriculum are there gaps where we're not even addressing these issues that today's coaches are focusing on? So you were talking about, college budgets being, responding 3, 4 years, from what's happened previous. It's the same with coach education. Coach education is rarely going to get out in front of trends. Coach education is usually a response to things that have happened within, like you said, the game. We were talking about trends in the game, tactical trends in the game. For this particular one, we're talking about, sociocultural influences that impact coaches and impact student athletes. So that's really where my dissertation is situated. The theoretical framework I'm using is culturally sustaining pedagogy, which is an asset-based approach that was developed probably in the mid to late 70s as culturally sustain responsive pedagogy and culturally relevant pedagogy. And a lot of these theoretical frameworks, they grow over time and they develop. I think what a lot of us see, if any of us are reading academic work, positive youth development is a theoretical framework that's utilized quite a bit in coach education, which it's a fantastic theoretical framework. But there are some gaps between that framework and culture sustaining pedagogy. And that space is really where we are today. Greater eclectic populations, ever-changing communities, the old way of coaching is just not effective anymore. Do it because I told you to do it. Command style approaches. It doesn't work. And perhaps it was never really working. But as I said earlier, in our generation, we just did it because the adult told us to do it. We have to find a better way. So ultimately, hopefully that all that makes sense. Those are the areas that I'm focusing in on right now. How can we train our coaches more effectively? I'm focusing on high school soccer because I have to focus on something. If I leave it wide open, then it's impossible to do a dissertation. You need to take it and get in here. So that's where the focus is in on high school coaches that are participating in US soccer coaching courses. And obviously there's a whole percentage of high school coaches that don't participate at all. And that's part of the gaps that are going to be in my dissertation that I will address, that it's not addressing every single issue that goes across high school soccer. We're talking specifically about coaches that participate in US soccer coaching and how that educational experience impacts their work.
Yeah, high school is very interesting because it can be, and I coached high school for 9 years, and we had the coaches like me that were going through the coaching education system up to the A license, and then we had the guys who I played high school, I still live in the community, and I want to coach, and then we had, hey, I'm an English teacher and I think soccer is interesting, so I'm going to go become a soccer coach. And aren't doing any education at all. And that's the complaint that we most commonly get. We talk to thousands and thousands and thousands of parents across the country. I've got a couple of Facebook groups that have well over 20,000 parents in them. And, you will hear, yeah, my kid's not going to play high school because it's a terrible experience. The coach doesn't know what they're doing. that
Yeah.
they're not teaching. They just
Yeah.
throw out a ball or they run
Yeah.
them to death,
Yeah.
and they think that that's soccer training. And then you get parents that will say, high school is the best part of my child's year,
Yeah.
that they look forward to playing high school the most.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
then, of course, everything in between.
Yeah. No, that's it. And that's where, you know, if you saw where I was 3 years ago, I was out there trying to split the atom, and that's why you have a dissertation chair and you have a committee and you have people helping you. And every time I talk with them, it's getting more and more narrow because you really do need to focus on a subgroup. You cannot focus on everything that is impacting high school soccer. But it's a very interesting space, US. I'm sorry, high school soccer is a very interesting space for all those things that you talked about. And I understand that completely. I don't think we're at the point where we can make you know, a coaching license compulsory with high school coaching, because like you said, you have the English teacher who is filling in because they need a soccer coach at that particular high school. But there must be some kind of a way that we can, and this will come in my recommendations when the dissertation is completed, and hopefully I'll be able to come up with 4 to 5 things that can positively impact how we can move forward. There has to be some kind of a flexible way that we can support coaches that are at various levels. So someone like yourself who's going to go through the coaching licenses no matter what, you know, that's a different type of person. And then the person who's a full-time employee in the school system and they're helping out as an assistant coach or a head coach, how can we find some kind of a way to do some kind of hybrid type, you know, a bridge training orientation to help these people? And again, if that's the case, what should we be emphasizing with a person like that? Should we be emphasizing the difference between a 4-4-2 and a 3-5-2, or emphasizing his or her ability to be able to engage with young people outside of a classroom setting? Classroom setting for an English teacher is completely different than when that English teacher steps out on the field and has 35 kids. So, you know, again, it comes to a matter of priority. And I think that, you know, it's, I'm halfway through the dissertation. I'm not going to be able to tell you at this point what it is. I'm not expecting high school coaches to be social workers. And I'm also not saying that we just do one little module and we tick a box. I think there it's something that's a little bit more comprehensive in that than, you know, how can we tie in you know, working in today's society within a coaching certification. And I've talked to the US soccer people about it. I think US soccer, I think the curriculum is going to feed in very well to this dissertation. I think there's going to be obvious gaps that are going to fall within the theoretical framework that I'm going to apply, but that's not going to construe that US soccer is faulty in their efforts. I actually think quite the opposite. I think they're ahead of the curve. I've looked at different curriculums or different setups from different federations, and US soccer is way ahead of a couple of European Union coach education programs that I've looked into in regards to how to engage with your population, where these other associations are still focusing primarily on performance. I think US soccer is ahead of the curve in regards to, you know, how we deal with you know, male players as opposed to female players and players from different backgrounds. I already see it in the curriculum. It's much more expansive. And I think it's going to reinforce a lot of the good work that's already taken place in US soccer, and then hopefully provide some insights that can bring it forward in the coming years. That's my hope anyway.
Right. I like that. I like that, brother. Well, you know what? I really appreciate you coming on. And when you're done with your dissertation, I'd love to have you back on, and I'll be calling you Dr. Murphy.
Yeah, you don't have to do that.
I'd love to have you on. No, I want to hear the
Yeah,
results.
no, I'll definitely come back on. No, in all seriousness, this is really a passion project for this point in my life, for doing a terminal degree. I have some personal motivations for it, but at the bottom of the list is a title that comes with it. I'm someone that cares about the game. Like you have put a lot of myself into it over the years, and I'm at a different point in my life now. So if I never get back into coaching, so be it. Perhaps my way of moving forward in the next 10, 15, 20 years is through coach education. And we definitely need to connect with our kids better. We need to show them more compassion. We need to show them more support. I'm concerned as a parent, and I'm concerned as a citizen. And I'm hoping that, perhaps this dissertation could be a small contribution towards adults leading our young people within our communities more effectively. And if we can use soccer in doing that, no one would be happier than me.
Well, thanks, Murph. I really appreciate your time, brother.
Yeah, thanks, Don. That was a lot of fun.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.